gentlemen, our first case for argument this morning is United States against Salinas.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Hannah Garst. I represent defendant appellant Mr. Salinas. The district court erred when it failed to grant Mr. Salinas' motion for judgment of acquittal because no rational trier of fact could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Salinas knew that the money was connected to a controlled substance. Now, this case hinges on Mr. Salinas' knowledge, whether he had actual knowledge of the controlled substance or whether he deliberately avoided learning that the money was connected to a controlled substance. Mr. Salinas was charged under 21 U.S.C. 841 and 846, and the defendant, to be convicted of those sections, the defendant must know that the substance in question is a controlled substance. Now, we believe that the government failed to prove that Mr. Salinas had actual knowledge that the money was connected to controlled substance or marijuana in this case. So we believe that it actually hinges on whether he deliberately avoided learning about the money's connection to the controlled substance. Now, the government had very little evidence on Mr. Salinas. He came in very late in the game and was out as quick as he came in. There was no evidence on how he got involved. Vargas and Villa did not know him. There was in a telephone call, Vargas said that he knew his brother. We know nothing of Vargas's brother. There was no evidence of it. Vargas tells Villa to call Mr. Salinas and tell him where to go. Mr. Salinas and Villa have several short conversations, which is basically the evidence that the government has, these three short conversations where they're discussing where to meet. Once Mr. Salinas comes on the scene, he meets Armando Vega Medina, and when they meet, they go to Vega Medina's home, come back with money, but the government, there's no evidence of what occurred during that time with Armando Vega Medina as far as what was said or any information other than the money was moved and then placed into the truck. The government then follows Mr. Salinas through Indiana, and eventually he's pulled over in Michigan. The money is taken, the truck's taken, his wallet's taken, and his phone is taken. And then the last thing that we hear is that Villa and Vargas have a telephone conversation detailing the stop, but we don't even know how they got that information. At trial, the government put forward this huge conspiracy. They explained that it involved heroin, cocaine, marijuana. Vargas had supplied Villa with 2,500 pounds of marijuana over the summer. They'd wiretapped 19 phones. And they had an expert that testified regarding Mexican drugs conspiracies and how they moved drugs from Mexico and Texas throughout the United States, and then how cash was paid back. And then the last word to the jury by the government equated Mr. Salinas as a drug trafficker because he changed his phone. Now, Mr. Salinas had testified and repeated what the expert had said regarding the fact that drug dealers change their telephone numbers. The government gets up and says, well, like Mr. Salinas just said, that's not true because look at this exhibit. He changed his telephone too. Well, yeah, he changed his telephone because the government confiscated his previous telephone. He didn't change the number. He just changed the phone. Now,
Ms. Garst, on the knowledge question, there obviously are a lot of suspicious circumstances here. If I've got this straight, Mr. Salinas makes a surreptitious pickup of $300,000 in cash from strangers, right? He's deadheaded to Chicago with his own empty truck. He picks up the cash very carefully packaged so that it will fit in this elaborate lead-lined storage hidden storage place in the refrigerator unit on his truck. He lies when he's stopped about whether he has cash with him. He lies then when it's found and claims it's his life savings when government has seen him pick it up a little earlier. Do you think from those facts it's reasonable for a jury to infer knowledge that the cash was probably involved in some sort of criminal enterprise?
I think it's probably reasonable to infer that the cash itself, I mean, you usually don't pick up $300,000.
From strangers or hide it in lead lined.
From strangers and hide it. I get that. Okay. But I think the problem is how the government charged it. When they charged it.
Well, the question, if it's reasonable to infer that it's from some sort of criminal enterprise, which I think it is, why isn't it also reasonable to infer that he's being willfully blind to the specifics?
Well, there's really no evidence connecting any drugs. I think what the government wanted the court and the jury to believe is, okay, so $300,000, the only reasonable explanation for that is drugs. And so we're going to put on all this evidence about this drug conspiracy, but there's no evidence connecting him to any drugs. I mean, it could have been from
That really doesn't answer my question. I mean, there's no doubt, is there, that this was drug money from Vargas and Vila and company, right?
Correct.
Okay. So why is it unreasonable to infer that with these facts showing Mr. Salinas, this has to be criminal proceeds, that he's then being deliberately blind, willfully blind, to the specific nature?
I don't think that he did anything that would show that he's being deliberately blind, that it's connected to drugs. I mean, even in the cases that talk about being willfully blind, I haven't found any cases where it's an 841 and 846, and you have to know. It's almost the second layer. Like, you not only have to know that the money, there's something wrong with the money, but the second layer is you have to know where the money came from.
You have to know it's drugs. You don't have to know what kind.
You don't have to know a kind.
So?
You have to know that it's drugs. But this money could have come from a lot of different ventures, which is what the expert agent Baumgartner said. That amount of money could have come, I mean, this court sees human trafficking, this court sees eBay conspiracies, that there's a lot of money involved. And in this case, there was no evidence that Mr.
So it doesn't occur to Mr. Salinas to ask, gee, where's this from? He's getting paid, presumably pretty handsomely, to engage in this obviously surreptitious transfer of cash. Why is it unreasonable to infer he's just closing his eyes? He's afraid of what he might find.
Well, I think that it's unreasonable because, again, it's the second layer. Like, I understand that with regard to the money itself. It'd be very difficult to say that he's not closing his eyes and saying that the money itself's not illegal. That would be unreasonable. And if he had been charged as conspiracy to launder money, I wouldn't be arguing sufficiency of the evidence.
No, you'd have a different argument.
I'd have a different argument, correct, Your Honor. But in this case, when he has to know the drugs, I mean, there's no evidence that he knew that Villa and Vargas were involved with drugs. There's no evidence that he himself was involved with drugs. In cases that have come through, and even McBride in 2013, the girlfriend was charged with conviction with conspiracy to launder money. But in that case, she knew her boyfriend was a drug dealer. So it's very hard to say that in that case that she didn't know or reasonably should have known that money derived from
drugs. We're in your rebuttal time. I just thought I'd let you know.
I'd like to say the rest. Thank you.
Ms. Christians.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Joanna Christensen on behalf of Rodolfo Vargas. The issue raised in Mr. Vargas's case is whether he was appropriately classified as a manager or supervisor in this offense when he was a mere middleman, relaying messages from a person only identified as Individual A to Villa. He had no contact with Mr. Salinas. He had no contact with Vega Medina. And what he did in this conspiracy was he oversaw, by relaying messages, the delivery of the marijuana and the proceeds back. He was Villa's contact, providing an extra layer between Individual A and Villa, obviously, because Villa cooperated. If Villa had known Individual A, he would have given up that information. He provided Salinas' number to Villa, although Mr. Vargas never spoke to Salinas, didn't even know his name until he was charged with him. And he instructed on how to package the proceeds, which came through the telephone chain from Salinas. The first initial problem in this case is the district court found based on the probation officer's finding in the pre-sentence report that Mr. Vargas was his manager or supervisor, and said at sentencing hearing that because Mr. Vargas had not challenged the facts as they were presented in the pre-sentence report, that he could not win on his argument. However, the district court is confusing challenging facts and challenging the law applied to those facts. Mr. Vargas did not challenge the facts of this case at sentencing, did not, and does not challenge them now. We do not dispute what the government says the facts are as to his role in this offense. However, we are challenging how those facts are applied to the law of manager supervisor. Because the district court made that finding, he made no finding on the factors that are usually considered when determining whether a defendant is manager or supervisor. Decision-making authority, there was no evidence of that. Literally relayed messages, so-and-so told me, he told me do this, he told me to tell you to do this. It's almost like a telephone operator connecting the two parties. The nature of his participation was just that. The government argues that he did so remotely to protect himself. He did all of this from Texas over the phone, whereas most of the other actions happened in Chicago, Indiana, Michigan. But that's where Mr. Vargas was, and he was the layer of protection for Individual A. He was merely used as a pawn to protect Individual A, and quite successfully, because, again, we do not know who this person is. He did not recruit anyone at all. He didn't know Salinas. His brother, Vargas's brother, recruited Salinas, but was not charged in this offense. He did not claim a larger share of the proceeds. We don't know how much anybody else got for their participation in the offense. We do know how much Mr. Vargas got, $25 per pound, which turns into quite a bit of money unless you consider the entire conspiracy itself. He did not do any planning or organizing. He simply relayed messages from one participant to another. He told Mr. Villa exactly how to package the money, which is what the probation officer relied on primarily from the enhancement. The government, in its brief, relies on his ability to coerce particularly Salinas, because at one point after Salinas has been stopped and pulled over, he says there's a thought that Salinas may have been lying about the traffic stop and stolen the money himself. And Mr. Vargas says if that's true, he will have to come clean up the house for a while to essentially work off this money. Well, that's an interesting threat, which may again have come from above, but he had no ability to enforce that threat because he didn't know who Salinas was. So, and then the last is administering sanctions, which is from this court's recent case in Weaver. And in both of the cases that rely on R and Bennett, where the defendant actually administered sanctions. And I see I'm into my rebuttal time. Unless the court has questions, I'll reserve my remaining minute. Thank you.
Baker.
May it please the court, Stephen Baker on behalf of the United States Appellee. Your Honors, there was ample evidence to show that the defendant Salinas understood that he was involved in a drug conspiracy. First and foremost, he met with an admitted drug dealer in Chicago in order to pick up over $300,000 in cash. That $300,000 was heat sealed in 16 separate packages. The jury heard testimony from a drug trafficking expert who testified that was consistent with the manner in which Mexican-based drug traffickers would package their money for shipment back to Mexico. Additionally, each one of those 16 packages had an individual card inside demarcated with a two-digit number, indicating the number of thousands of dollars, which they also heard testimony from the drug trafficking expert. That's how they would package the money. Additionally, that money was sent down a known drug trafficking organization route back to Mexico, where the drugs had initially been supplied and where the money was now being returned. Salinas was doing all these things. Finally, there was also testimony from the drug trafficking expert and from a state trooper that the lead-lined compartment, the hidden compartment that the court alluded to a second ago.
It's a very strange locution, a drug trafficking expert. sounds like a former defendant in one of these cases.
Judge, it's amazing how close a drug trafficking expert is in terms of his knowledge to a former defendant in one of these cases, but ours was Chuck Baumgartner, who I know this court has seen a lot. He investigated a lot of those cases.
Former drug traffickers to give this testimony. That's actually what the government does in computer hacking cases. You hire real hackers.
That's true, Judge. There is a credibility consideration in these cases, but the court's
that
point
be
is well taken.
A problem in the hacking cases as well.
I think so. But perhaps the knowledge base is narrower in those cases, Judge. We do have a cybercrime section. I'll check it out. In terms of this case, though, Judge, that testimony was before the jury, and there was ample information for the jury to find that this defendant, Mr. Salinas, had knowledge. Separate from that, as Judge Hamilton raised, all of the information we presented, along with the concealment in terms of the circumstantial information about this defendant, indicated that he would have knowledge. But beyond that, because of his livelihood, because of what he did, he was deliberately avoiding. To the extent that he didn't conclude or himself follow up on his own suspicions to find out exactly what he was doing, he was deliberately avoiding them. And he had a great deal of deliberate nature and time and action in this case in terms of the amount of time he spent on a 100-degree day putting this cash in this compartment within his refrigeration unit. The instruction in the case was correct. It was this circuit's pattern instruction at the time, and it's been approved by this court previously.
On the instruction issue, Mr. Baker, can you give us some idea of what's happening in district courts in the wake of the global tech opinion dealing with deliberate blindness, in essence, to knowledge? So our pattern instruction committee has kind of backed away from language in the wake of global tech. I mean, I know here it's on plain error review and so on, but if you could tell us something about what's happening, I'd be grateful.
Judge, I can. From our office's perspective, and separate and apart from the record here, as you know, it's absent concerning those things. From our office's perspective, and in several of the district courts, several members of which were on the panel, that consideration that's in the notes of the current panel instruction, mm-hmm. consider global tech, several other circuits have, that's exactly what's happening. I am not aware that instruction has put in play. In fact, I don't believe it has been put in play in any of the Northern District's instructions yet. But from our office's perspective, we would propose when we have a pattern instruction from the circuit, unless there's some reason to specify it with regard to the facts of the case, we will stick as closely as possible to the pattern instruction to avoid appellate issues and to give the instruction given. In that sense, we follow the note and we look through what it is. Deliberate avoidance doesn't come up all that often. In these cases, it does. With respect to the global tech instruction, I am not aware it's been given in the Northern District at all. Here it wasn't.
Was there any evidence in this trial on how much Salinas got paid for taking the cash or how much he was supposed to get paid?
Not specifically, Judge, no. Okay. There was evidence that he posted $5,000 in a cashier's check in order to reclaim this money. And in that filing that you noted, Judge, he claimed that it was his money. Finally, judges, in terms of the second defendant, Mr. Vargas, there was substantial evidence presented at trial and before the district court, which was the trial court in Mr. Salinas' case. The district court actually noted at Mr. Vargas' sentencing that he was relying on the trial information as well. You've seen all of that in the course of your review here, that Mr. Vargas merited the enhancement. And specifically, counsel mentions it, but in terms of the coercion, the control of Mr. Salinas, another individual, or Mr. Villa, post Salinas' arrest, there's a good deal of evidence in Mr. Vargas' conversation that he could bring Mr. Salinas to bear. He was also instructing Villa on how to follow up on information so he could find out where that money went and whether this information had been correctly delivered. He had an exacting retell in those conversations of exactly what happened on the stop. His conversation with Mr. Villa reads very much like the state trooper's report of how the stop occurred. All of that information, the additional of the hiring of a lawyer to check into that stop to follow up on the money, and most tellingly, the statement about Mr. Salinas, thus used a pejorative word for him, this effort will bring him, he'll clean the house until we figure this out. It shows that he has control over other members of this conspiracy, shows, and I mean, Mr. Salinas' response to that, filing a notice of claim for this money, which was not his, posting $5,000, showed that that control was very real, and Mr. Salinas felt that threat. If the court does not have any further questions, the government will rest on its brief. and ask that the court affirm both decisions of the district court below.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Any further, Ms. Garst?
Your Honor, I just want to respond briefly to the global tech. Mm-hmm. We believe that the global tech would apply to the ostrich instruction, but the way that the Supreme Court wrote it, we believe it would also apply to the court's definition of deliberate avoidance. And in that case, it did, the Supreme Court did overturn the Federal Circuit's definition or their test because it didn't require an active effort.
Right. Have we ever found, or has any other court that you know of, found plain error in giving a pattern-approved instruction without objection?
Your Honor, I don't know of any cases in that. The other thing I want to just touch on briefly is that the question here is what Mr. Salinas knew. And the government presented overwhelming evidence of the conspiracy itself. But again, I just want to reiterate, he did not know that, there's no evidence that he knew that Vargas and Beeler were drug dealers. There's no evidence that he knew that the money was packaged just the way drug dealers package money. There's no evidence that he knew that this was being driven on a drug route. For these reasons, we ask that you reverse the conviction. Thank you, Your Honors. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ms. Garst. Ms. Christensen, anything further?
I'll just respond briefly to the government's argument. First, it is impossible for someone to be coerced by an individual that they don't even know exists. So Mr. Vargas may have given some sort of threat to Villa about what was going to happen to the person who was driving the truck. But Mr. Salinas didn't know my client existed until they were charged in this case. He knew, presumably, about whoever he was going to deliver the proceeds to, but that was not my client. And the second point I have is the evidence presented at Mr. Salinas' trial. Mr. Vargas was not at trial. He pled guilty. And while the judge sat there, if we were not co-defendants in the same appeal, that evidence would not be in Mr. Vargas's record at all. He had no opportunity to cross-examine, and although this is at sentencing, there should be some opportunity for the defendant to object to evidence that's used against him, and there was none in this case. It's for these reasons we ask the court to reverse and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Garst, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement. Our second case.